In a venue like Turning Point USA, which is the base of the base, I decide on a very deliberate strategy that I repeated throughout the debate, but really emphasized in my opening remarks, which was to hammer home this point, no pun intended, that the foreign policy presented by libertarians like Dave Smith and old school isolationists like Tucker Carlson, they might think of this as America first. They might think of it as MAGA. They might think of it as conservative. But according to President Trump, it is none of the above there. In Gaza, it has been, according to John Spencer, 1 to 1.5, which is the most humane ratio in literally the entire history of urban warfare fighting. Dave Smith looks back at me and he kind of says, "But look at all the rubble." And everyone in the audience starts like applauding. Not everyone, a lot of people start applauding. So this is kind of the fundamental issue of our time.
And I'm so curious, because you were actually there in the room. What was your sense in terms of the divide? What was the ratio of support for you versus support for Dave? Okay, so unless you've been living under a rock for the past week, you will have seen that our guest today, who I feel so privileged to be joined by, Josh Hammer, you will have seen him all over social media for his epic performance in an Israel debate with Dave Smith at a Turning Point USA event moderated by Charlie Kirk. And I want to show you a few clips of this debate, which I thought was both, I think Josh did a superb, sterling job in articulating Israel's case and dealing with the arguments leveled at Israel's door, particularly by a growing amount of the right in America, but also this a nauseating kindergarten morality of Dave Smith. And I want to show you a few clips of the debate before we jump into a discussion about it. But just for a bit of context, unless you don't know who Josh is, Josh is a journalist, author of Israel and Civilization. He's the host of The Josh Hammer Show and senior editor at large of Newsweek. But let's first just show you a couple of clips that I wanted to pick out to give you a flavor of this debate. Have a watch.
As far as the 12-day war goes, the war never needed to be launched to begin with. Iran did not have nuclear weapons. Iran, according to all of the intelligence.
Charlie, this notion that AIPAC is this big, powerful lobby can be dispelled with literally one anecdote. And I only need one anecdote to dispel this oft-repeated notion, which is the entire 2014 to 2015 Barack Obama-Iran nuclear debate. The fact that the JCPOA, Barack Obama's Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action nuclear deal passed, is literally the singular data point that disproves the entire alleged existence of the nefarious Israel lobby that controls all politics.
What is your response to the human shield argument? It has been proven.
Yes.
It is legit. What is your response to a fact? We don't know how widespread it's done, but I think it's rather that Hamas uses human shields.
Yeah, they certainly have. I'm not denying that. But at the same time, like, you got to work around that, bro.
Charlie, I would be very, very curious, based on Dave's recent tweets about Donald Trump doing XYZ things, whether it's covering up for a pedophile ring or engaging in foreign wars, all on behest of a foreign power. Does Dave actually think that Donald Trump, J.D. Vance, the entire Trump administration are literally bought off by the Jews? Is that actually your honest stance?
First of all, Josh, congratulations for such a brilliant and calm performance in the face of so much lies and hostility, especially as you said at the start, you were fasting because it was the 17th of Tammuz. Thank you so much for joining us. And how did you feel at the end of that debate?
Well, Ollie, it's great to make your acquaintance. Thank you for having me on the show. Look, this was a very lively debate. I've been doing this political commentary, talking, writing, speaking thing now for, give or take 6-7 years, something like that. And this was definitely one of the bigger events that I've spoken at. Charlie promoted it a lot leading up to the event. He's been talking about it a lot this week on his show. And I've just gotten just utterly bombarded since the event with all sorts of texts and emails and social media messages there. So the response has been pretty overwhelming. I feel that I was effective in achieving the number one aim that I intended to do, which, you know, we didn't show it there in that particular clip, but I devoted my opening remarks. Not everyone loved this strategy, but in a venue like Turning Point USA, which is the base of the base, this is a super pro-Trump, MAGA, America First, grassroots movement. Charlie, who's a friend of mine, is known to be very close to the president. I decide on a very deliberate strategy that I repeated throughout the debate, but really emphasized in my opening remarks, which was to hammer home this point, no pun intended, that the foreign policy presented by libertarians like Dave Smith and old school isolationists like Tucker Carlson, they might think of this as America First. They might think of it as MAGA. They might think of it as conservative. But according to President Trump, who has brought those terms, America First and MAGA, back into being, it is none of the above there. There is something of a pernicious gaslighting operation going on before our eyes from people like Dave Smith and Tucker Carlson to try to convince a lot of Trump voters and Trump supporters and Americans at large that what they think America First is actually not what it is there. And that, this is kind of my deliberate point there, was to remind this audience that no, what the other guy is saying, he can think whatever he wants. Libertarians, frankly, have a lot of crazy ideas on a lot of issues there. But whatever he may or may not think on this issue or any other, this is not the president's foreign policy there. And more generally, the president's foreign policy, which we can call nationalism, realism, sober empiricism. Some people call it Jacksonianism, which is a reference to the early 19th century President Andrew Jackson. Whatever term you want to apply to it there. The point is that there is a middle ground between these two ideological extremes of Bush-era neoconservatism on the one hand and Tucker Carlson isolationism. I think a lot of people, especially in this younger Turning Point USA audience, grew up, as in many ways I did as well, in the shadow of America's failed regime change wars overseas. The failures in Iraq, Afghanistan, Barack Obama's intervention in Libya in 2011. And because they grew up in this milieu of these failures, they immediately rush all the way to the other extreme and embrace Ron Paul, Tucker Carlson-style isolationism. But there is a middle ground here, and that was above all what I was trying to accomplish, and I feel pretty good that I accomplished that.
And I'm so curious, because you were actually there in the room. What was your sense in terms of the divide? What was the ratio of support for you versus support for Dave?
Hard to say, right? Very difficult to say. We both had our applause lines. We both had our cheer lines. I will say that Dave Smith was booed at least twice. I don't think I was booed a single time. So, you know, take that for whatever. Take that for whatever it's worth. Look, my general sense here, again, we're talking about young MAGA pro-Trump activists. That's really the Turning Point USA bread and butter, especially this is the Student Action Summit. My sense of this crowd, Ali, is effectively the following. These are young, patriotic Americans, many of whom, not all of whom, but many of whom are Christians, probably oftentimes religious Christians. And I think many of them do indeed have a natural affinity towards the Jewish state of Israel, indeed in many ways towards the Jewish people, the Holy Land, all of the above. On the other hand, as I was just saying, they grew up in this milieu, in this time and context where they kind of just are scarred and they've been taught to be scarred by the failures of past American military involvement overseas. So they're having, I think, a tough time reconciling that, especially when it comes to the special U.S.-Israel relationship. It's my job in a venue like that, as someone who is, you know, not just the author of Israel and Civilization, not just a proud Jew and Zionist, but it's also my job as someone who talks and writes about all the issues, who has pretty undisputed bona fides as a conservative, as a very strong conservative. It is really my job in that setting to make the case to that particular venue in a way that they can relate to. And again, I think that I was successful, but Dave Smith definitely has his fans there. In many ways, this false dichotomy between militaristic adventurism abroad or isolationism, I think a lot of people have intuited this. So we have work to do in trying to claw back from it.
But is it really as benign as just, it's just about they grew up seeing the dangers of interventionism, so they're super isolationist? Or are you not concerned that we're clearly seeing a rise, and Charlie acknowledged this, and obviously you acknowledge this, that there's something that I really didn't predict, but there is a rise of a much more sinister form of anti-Jewish sentiment that sometimes doesn't express it, you know, explicitly as such, but it's so clearly, and we'll talk about some of the things Dave and Tucker and others said, it's so clearly tapping into age-old anti-Jewish tropes. Are you not concerned that this is starting to, you know, it's not just benign, it's a bit more sinister, maybe even tapping into some Christian anti-Semitic tropes of old? And are you concerned that that's going to start to rise on the right in America?
Yes, I am unambiguously concerned. No doubt about that whatsoever. And look, there's various factors that we can point to try to say as to maybe why this is happening. First of all, let me say, you know, the Republican Party is not the Nazi Party. The Republican Party institutionally, the Trump administration, you know, these are great friends of the Jewish people, tremendous friends. I mean, frankly, even holding aside foreign policy in the Israel context, the current administration, Trump administration, just on a domestic level, are you kidding me? I mean, what they've done in their battles with higher education when it comes to fighting against it's really incredible.
I'm not talking about the administration. I'm talking about the future of the grassroots.
For sure. No. I know that. I'm just clarifying here that it's kind of a complicated picture. Look, sure. I think that there is a rising trend of people that it's predominantly online, but it is seeping into real life. You know, you mentioned Charlie Kirk, who moderated this event. Charlie does a lot of these campus talks, and a number of these videos have gone viral on social media of him getting confronted by young neo-Nazis on these campuses, trying to pin him down about various esoteric verses from the Talmud. And I said this on Charlie's show earlier this week, actually. I was like, dude, my friend, it breaks my heart that this is where we are as a society in the year 2025, that you as a 31-year-old young Christian are being tasked with defending the Talmud. I mean, it's nuts. I mean, it's utterly preposterous.
Yeah.
So, yes, there is a rise in some quarters, I think, of a bit of a theological issue within the Christian church. Tucker Carlson is the tip of the spear of this, as he is with so many of our other current maladies. Tucker Carlson had some sort of theologian on his show a few months ago, who was a co-author of a book, I believe, with the founder of Gab, Andrew Torba, a well-known neo-Nazi. And his co-author went on Tucker's show to promote a very, very hard version of what Christians oftentimes refer to as replacement theology, that there's nothing special about the Jewish nation and blah, blah, blah. Unsurprisingly, this guy is viciously anti-Israel when it comes to his own foreign policy. So this is definitely on the rise. I do not think that it is a mainstream sentiment, but it's something that really scares me, especially as an American, because America was founded with a strand of Protestantism that was deeply philo-Semitic and deeply heavily reliant on the Hebrew Bible, on the Hebrew scripture. It's all throughout the American founding fathers era literature. It's inscribed in our Liberty Bell in Philadelphia. I mean, this was bread and butter to the founding fathers' vision of the United States. So to have some sort of polar opposite strand of theology make even any inroads is deeply disconcerting. The other thing that I think is going on here is essentially the following, which is that you have had a tremendous decline in trust here in the United States in anything that smacks of authority figures and authority and gatekeeping and institutions at large. There are any number of data points to point to. There was the Russia collusion hoax back in the 2016 election. There was the 2020 election in general, which a lot of people still dispute to this day. The Hunter Biden laptop, COVID-19 probably being the number one issue with all the lockdowns and all that. There's a lot of examples. A lot of people have lost trust. And I'm not saying that that's a bad thing. I have lost a lot of trust too, actually. These institutions and individuals, people like Anthony Fauci, have really kind of done this to themselves. Rather, I simply note that historically speaking, when trust goes away, when people just start to ask anything for the sake of asking anything, this is typically where the notion of the scapegoat and the Jews historically get invoked. So I do think right. that is a little bit of what's going on here as well. Not a majority, but a little bit of it.
Yeah, yeah. And it concerns me as well. And my sense is that Charlie Kirk, who I've followed for a long time, who has been a staunch, not just a supporter of Israel and Jewish people, a staunch supporter of Israel, you know, as precisely as you said, going out to bat on his own on campuses, debating with people about Talmud and other Jewish issues. But I am picking up from him that he is feeling increasingly aware and, you know, sensitive to the fact that, I don't know how much, but a growing part of his base. I mean, look, I just did an interview with Glenn Beck a couple of days ago, and we spoke about all kinds of issues, and particularly about his support for Israel and rising anti-Semitism on both the left and the right. Anyway, he shared it on his Twitter, I just saw just now on X, and almost every comment was anti-Semitic and anti-Israel. And you're right, maybe this is just limited to online, but it's definitely something that is on the rise and that I didn't really see coming. But one of the conundrums that I have had of recent times is, why are people like, okay, fine, you're an author, you're a journalist, you're a whatever, but can you make sense of the greatest conundrum of all over the last few weeks, which is, why is a comedian like Dave Smith getting so much airtime for his views on the Middle East?
Look, let me just say a quick word about Glenn Beck, who I've known for, I don't know, 8 years, 9 years, give or take now. Glenn is a genuine, from the bottom of his heart, friend
for sure.
of Jewish people.
For sure.
The very first time I met Glenn Beck at the Blaze TV studios in the Dallas, Texas area, give or take 8 years ago, we had a long, sprawling hour and a half conversation. And I remember to this day that in that conversation, Glenn told me that for all of his children, he made sure that at some point in their teenage years and their young adulthood, he would take them all to the concentration camps and then to Israel to really instill sure. these deep lessons. So he's just, he really is a tremendous friend. And, you know, it is like what you're seeing on his X account is partially real, but partially not real. I want to talk you off the ledge at least a little bit. There is plenty of reason for thinking. And we have not gotten the transparency from the current folks at X, Elon Musk, and all the leadership. We have not gotten the transparency that I think many of us would like to see. We have not necessarily gotten the crackdown on foreign-funded bots. But there's all sorts of ample anecdotal reason for thinking that a lot of the stuff on X is truly orchestrated by foreign powers here. And a lot of people, it's pure speculation, but a lot of people speculate Russia, Iran, Qatar. For instance, look, Charlie did like one of these Who Won the Debate Hammer Smith tweets, and Smith got 60%, which, to be honest with you, I actually was not too upset about that, because given kind of the, you know, the bot overrun nature yeah. and the fact that a lot of these neo-Nazis in general are tend to be disproportionately representative on that particular medium on X, formerly known as Twitter, I was not necessarily losing a ton of sleep over it. But I don't want to downplay it either. I mean, it definitely is happening. It definitely is happening. Now, I'll give you just kind of one example to show you. This is kind of one of my wake-up moments on this, so to speak, there. I was speaking to a group in Washington, D.C. last year. I will leave off the name, but a conservative organization, essentially, for young conservatives, kind of like a credentialing type of organization there. And I was speaking with some of the young fellows, and one of these guys was from Texas. I used to live in Texas myself. I know quite well the senator from Texas, Ted Cruz. I actually helped Ted Cruz with his 2020 book. I was involved with this presidential campaign back in 2016. We go back a while. So I asked this young up-and-coming conservative activist from Texas what he thinks of his senator, Ted Cruz. And he kind of said, he's okay. And I was like, really? Well, what is your criticism? And he said, he just talks way too much about Israel. I was like, oh. Well, that's kind of interesting. So, I mean, I have had these data points, right? And by the way, this is a very common sentiment that I hear from a lot of young conservatives, which is that they're not necessarily anti-Israel. They just have this perception, whether it's real or not real, that way too much of American political discourse is focused on Israel and U.S.-Israel relations there. So this is a very, very, very common complaint that I hear from young folks.
Right. Very interesting. It'll be interesting to see which way it goes. Now, in the debate itself, towards the end, Charlie Kirk said, look, we clearly have found some room for agreement. And I thought, this isn't really agreement as much as you want to spin it that way, because essentially you agreed on the fact that American aid should stop towards Israel, but for totally opposite reasons, because Dave hates Israel and because you want to see Israel sovereign. Then he says, we both agree Jew hate is wrong. Okay, great. You might agree that in principle, but if you're putting fuel into the fire, which I think Dave is doing, then it's right. irrelevant that you may say that. And then likewise, like, you know, you said, we both agree all human beings are created in the image of God. Okay, great. You know, but your plan for how you deal with issues of war and peace and Hamas and all that are totally the opposite. So would you agree with me that essentially there is no agreement in this debate? Before we continue with the video, I just had to quickly share with you something really important. We are told that Israel's actions are the cause of the Israeli-Arab conflict, but we've just released a groundbreaking documentary proving that Arab-Islamic Jew hatred far predates Israel's re-establishment. This is the critical fact that everyone needs to learn about. Have a watch of our trailer now. Picture yourself. It's 1834, and you're a Jew living in Tzfat, which is a northern city in Israel, then under the Ottoman Empire. Your family is part of this ancient city's spiritual heart for generations. You study Torah, you trade in the market, and live quietly among your Arab neighbors. But one day, a mob storms your street, shouting, "Kill the Jews!" Your home is looted, your synagogue burned, your loved ones beaten. This isn't about Israel. Israel won't exist for 114 years. This isn't about settlements, the IDF, or the 1948 displacements. This is raw, violent hatred aimed at you for being a Jew. And it's not just in Palestine. It's part of a centuries-old story of anti-Semitism woven into Arab and Islamic history, from the dawn of Islam to the streets of Hebron. The claim that this conflict began with Israel's creation, the Nakba, or modern policies, is a farce, a distortion that collapses under history's magnifying glass. Welcome to JTV Plus, I'm Ollie Annersfeld, and today we're uncovering a history too often buried, the relentless anti-Semitism among Arabs in Palestine before 1948, rooted in a broader Arab and Muslim hostility that began with Islam's inception in the 7th century. To watch this JTV Plus documentary and access much more premium content, click on the link in the video description.
Yeah, look, Charlie's a friend, like I said, and I understand what he was trying to do there to try to end the debate on a kind of a happy, uplifting, positive note. I understand why, as the moderator and the host of the whole conference, he wants to do that. But it definitely struck me as a bit of a stretch at that time. I mean, that was a pretty fiery exchange. And, you know, I'm sure there are any number of other issues where Dave Smith and I agree. I'm sure I know that we were both, you know, opponents of the COVID-19 lockdown policy. I'm sure we both object to biological males competing in women's sports and all these various totally exogenous issues there. But when it comes to what was being discussed in that debate stage, there was very little in the way of agreement. I tend to agree with you.
And when Dave Smith said about the whole human shields thing, he said, well, look, you know, at the end of the day, it's like if a school was there was terrorists that took a whole school hostage, you wouldn't just bomb the school. So you just got to figure it out, bro. I actually took personal offense at what he said there, because hundreds of Israeli soldiers have laid down their lives, and many hundreds more lost limbs for life as a result of showing unparalleled surgical precision going after Hamas.
That's right.
Way more. So,
for example,
a friend of mine pointed out recently that the Iraqi forces, supported by the West, when they went to destroy an ISIS-controlled Mosul, 40,000 were killed. 36,000 of those were civilians to kill 4,000 ISIS terrorists. And no one talks about that being genocide. And so for him to say that, when it's like, imagine if you... I thought, let's play with his example for a second. Okay, so let's say that the police go into that school and they manage to cordon off most of the children to an area and they kill the terrorists, but 20 kids get caught in the crossfire. You'd say, wow, they did an impeccable job. So it's pretty disgraceful what he's saying, isn't it?
Yeah, and look, I did bring up John Spencer, right? John Spencer is the head of urban warfare studies at West Point. I mean, By any comparison, this man is the world's single leading expert. I know we're in a very anti-expert age. I get that. But this man literally, like, actually is the expert when it comes to urban warfare. I mean, West Point, are you kidding me? I mean, this is the United States Military Academy. He was actually there in Fallujah. He was there in Iraq in 2016 during the initially Obama, then into Trump, the counterinsurgency against ISIS. And he's crunched the numbers. And best as he can tell, The IDF has done an even better job when it comes to civilian to combatant ratio in a tightly condensed urban warfare setting than even the U.S. Army did. And the U.S. Army did a pretty darn good job, actually. But the literal ratio in the Iraq counterinsurgency, I forgot exactly what it was, but it was around one militant for every 2.5 to 3 civilians, give or take. In Gaza, it has been, according to John Spencer, 1 to 1.5, which is the most humane ratio in literally the entire history of urban warfare fighting, according to John Spencer. So, look, here's the issue, Ollie. This is the issue. So Dave Smith and I have debated before. We debated in February back at Princeton University in New Jersey for a Steamboat Institute event at that time. And I made a lot of these similar facts at that time to try to persuade Smith and the audience that Israel is not committing genocide. I'm also a lawyer, so I cited the Geneva Conventions. I read the actual definition of genocide. I made all these arguments. And at the time, I will never forget this. Dave Smith looks back at me and he kind of says, well, look at all the rubble. And like everyone in the audience just starts like applauding. Not everyone, but a lot of people start applauding. So this is kind of the fundamental issue of our time. And I've had a lot of these private discussions with my friends who are engaged in a similar line of work. For me, the public battle of ideas, it's not easy to be in this line of work when you are someone like me who tries to read and to be informed and to like care about like logic and facts and law and things that once upon a time everyone cared about. But we live in a deeply, deeply emotional day and age. I guess to put it another way, I've been friends with Ben Shapiro for a long time now, about maybe a decade. And one of Ben's slogans that really kind of made him famous early on was his tagline, "The facts don't care about your feelings." And Perhaps that was true. That may have been true at the time that Ben said it. But I'm not sure that it's true today. I am genuinely unsure. In fact, if I had to think out loud here, I would say it's probably oftentimes sadly untrue in these types of public exchanges.
Well, there's this faked Twitter account. I'm sure you've seen it, Titania McGrath, which is basically sort of meant to be like an ultra woke fake person. And the tagline is "Feelings don't care about your facts." And that may well describe the age we're in. But I mean, look, you have basically you and I are able to just take a step back and just appreciate the context of Jewish history and the tropes leveled at Jews. And when I was watching this debate and listening to what Dave Smith was saying and Tucker Carlson and others, and I'm basically hearing the obsession with Israel, precisely as you said, what about all these other conflicts with far worse civilian to combatant ratios? This obsession with Jews, you know, AIPAC and Jews controlling things when actually, if you zoom out objectively, there isn't a disproportionate influence. This description of, as you said, the rubble. What about the rubble? Like Jews being killers, you know, blood libels, etc. And then Tucker Carlson, you know, talking about Epstein, some kind of grand conspiracy, which is like, you know, protocols, elders of Zion, this kind of thing.
Yep.
This surely is tapping into age-old anti-Jewish tropes, isn't it?
Look, so on the one hand, I'm inclined to take all these issues one at a time. On the other hand, you're right to kind of lump it all in together and say that kind of zooming out and looking at the totality of a lot of these different issues, yes, there is definitely a rise in anti-Semitism. And I am hardly the first person to acknowledge that. A lot of it has shockingly risen after October 7th. The thing that is most concerning to me as a conservative American is that it is no longer exclusively confined, by and large, to the American left. It really is slowly seeping into the mainstreams of the right. Now, again, I don't want to sound the alarm necessarily. I am not saying that the median person who self-identifies as a conservative, a Trump supporter, a Trump voter, or this or that, has any malice in his heart towards the Jewish people. That is certainly not my contention, very far from the case, in fact. But on a percentage basis, it definitely is rising. Okay, and there is very little doubt about that. On the Epstein thing in particular, here is what I will say. I think that there are legitimate reasons to be frustrated with how the Trump administration has handled it. Certainly, the Attorney General Pam Bondi seemingly has done an actual irreconcilable flip flop. So I think it's totally justified to be upset with her. You also could be the kind of person that is genuinely upset because there's not going to be justice for victims. I mean, frankly, that ship sailed a very long time ago during the Bush administration, but neither here nor there for present purposes. And you could also be upset just because this gives the impression of a so-called deep state cover-up, and that kind of brings a lot of people back to the Russiagate hoax and a lot of the stuff that derailed Trump's first term. So there are legitimate reasons to be concerned. Sure. But with that very large caveat aside, yes, there are definitely a lot of people here who just love baselessly saying that Jeffrey Epstein was Mossad. Tucker is a great example, and just playing right into these fanning of the flames that these people know exactly what they're doing. That is definitely part of what's happening here.
Right. And I'm really not against asking questions, looking into things, and then there may well be all kinds of questions to ask around the Epstein thing. It's more just about whether you're therefore taking bits of information and therefore saying Israel this, Jews that, and you know, I think it can be pretty clear whether someone is in the first camp of just like trying to get to the truth and the other camp of trying to play into darker tropes. But one thing I was particularly interested to ask you about, and I've been thinking about this for a while, is the question of America's aid to Israel, support for Israel, recently their involvement in Iran. Now, people debate either way. Is it in America's strategic interest to support Israel? You made a very strong case for it in the debate. I think it's so clearly the case. First of all, with Iran, you know, they say death to America just as much as they do death to Israel. They've killed Americans' troops and they plot terrorist attacks and all that kind of stuff. But just more generally, the support of Israel. I was wondering if, because you did tap into this in the debate, you spoke about it's not just about strategic interests, it's also about values and deeply shared values, and so much of the American Republic and Constitution the ideas of it were birthed in Israel. But I was actually interested to show you a clip from a recent interview I did with, I don't know if you know this man, Rabbi Manis Friedman, very popular rabbi on YouTube. And I was talking to him about this and I said, you know, what if it were the case that there was no political benefit to supporting Israel? And he had this to say. But in particular, one of the things I'm hearing from some people, even in the Trump camp, is they say, enough with coming to Israel's aid. It's time for America first. And they don't see why America should involve themselves in Israel's wars. And I wondered what your thoughts were on that. Do you think they have something legitimate here in thinking that they should be involved in their own issues? If there's a direct threat to America, fine. But let's just say that it was just a threat to Israel and that was it. Do you think that they're right to say we shouldn't come to Israel's aid?
Politically, they're absolutely correct. But on the cosmic stage, if you don't come to Israel's aid, it's your loss. Like Mordechai said to Esther, you have an opportunity to do this great thing. If you don't do it, somebody else will. So it's not like we're dependent on you. But if you want to be on the right side of history, if you want to be on the right side of morality, then you go into Germany and you wipe out Nazis. Not politically, morally. So politically, they're right. Let America take care of America and let Israel take care of Israel. But then at the same time, don't tell Israel what to do. You can't have it both ways.
What do you think? What do you think about that, Josh?
There's a lot of truth to that. I would probably formulate it slightly differently. So I do tend to think about foreign policy in broadly realist terms. For instance, to give a very crass example, I am a fan of the U.S.-Saudi alliance, even though the U.S. and Saudi Arabia have virtually nothing in common whatsoever when it comes to values or religion or anything there. I am interested in Saudi Arabia solely and exclusively as a deterrent against America's enemies, namely the Iranian regime and its many proxies. So that's a good example that I oftentimes invoke to kind of demonstrate my typically amoral, let's say, approach to foreign policy. Having said that, yes, there are some exceptions. And anyone who's even remotely familiar with the political theory of the American founding, with what this country was conceived to be there, could tell you that there was always a certain longing, we might say, and definitely a certain connection between the United States and Israel more broadly. Obviously not just the state of Israel, because there was no such thing when America was founded, but really just the concept of Israel, the concept of the chosen people, the Hebrew Bible, and so forth. There's frankly more examples than I could possibly, you know, give you on this show. I actually write about this at great length in my book, Israel and Civilizations. Go ahead and check it out as well. But look, just really briefly here, we have the notion that folks like Thomas Jefferson and Benjamin Franklin actually proposed that the national seal of the United States would be Moses parting the Red Sea with the Israelites, because they, much like the pilgrims who sailed on the Mayflower in 1620, thought of themselves as modern day Israelites crossing their version of the Red Sea. You know, similarly, speaking of the Mayflower, Sir William Bradford, who was the captain of the Mayflower, which famously lands in Plymouth Colony, Massachusetts, essentially the first people here in what was then called the New World. Sir William Bradford, the captain of the ship, spoke about 1,000 words of Hebrew, actually. And he was a student of an English Christian Hebraist by the name of Sir Henry Ainsworth. And there was some chatter on the Mayflower about possibly just ditching the English language and just starting anew and having a clean break and basically just starting to speak Hebrew. Didn't happen, obviously, but there was some chatter of it. There are all these wonderful, beautiful quotations as well, where, among others, Alexander Hamilton, one of my very favorite founding fathers, essentially says that one of the clearest ways that he knows that God exists is that the Jewish people are still here. John Adams, our second president, famously describes the Jewish people as being the great civilizing force of all of humanity and mankind. Abraham Lincoln, my single favorite figure in American history, refers to Americans as an almost chosen people. This is a man who quoted the Hebrew Bible in virtually every public speech he gave. And on and on and on we go. So it really is just a truly deep part of this nation's fabric and of our DNA. Even many biblical legal ideas actually find their way into both the English common law and the American constitutional order, actually. So One of the great early conservative English common lawyers, this is a pretty obscure reference, but I'm going to whip it out anyway. So a late 14th century, early 15th century conservative English common lawyer by the name of John Fortescue. So he was credited with first codifying into the common law this notion that the king, the monarch, is not above the law. And do you know what he cited for that proposition? What he cited for that proposition that is part of the English common law that the king is not above the law? He cited the book of Deuteronomy because it is very clear there in the middle chapters, right around chapter 16, 17, if memory serves, in Deuteronomy, that the king is actually not above the law. America, of course, famously invokes that into our own constitutional inheritance as well. So much of our ethics, our law, it all comes from downstream, ultimately, of the Bible. And in many ways, the Hebrew Bible, what our Christian friends refer to as the Old Testament. So with that in mind, yes, there are certain alliances on the world stage that are, shall we say, extra realist, that kind of transcend pure transactional realism, that definitely are special. And this is one that I think would kind of, you know, be at the top of the list there for both Jews and Christians alike, by the way. I've spoken with, oh my God, so many Christians in my entire lifetime who are political activists here in America who just speak so movingly about the Holy Land and how much they pray for it every day there. So this really is a part of the United States at this point.
Absolutely.
Not literally. I mean, obviously, Israel's not literally the 51st state. But this notion of this Judeo-Christian biblical inheritance, this ecumenical biblical structure, this is really a part of who we are, is what I mean.
Absolutely. And as Charlie Kirk actually said to me once directly, that he said, without the Torah, you do not have America. This is the last, if we have just one or two more minutes before we finish, I'd just love to ask you one final question, which is just to know if you could, if you'd be happy to share with us a little bit more about your own personal journey. Because from what I read, you've kind of been on your own religious Jewish journey, getting more in touch with all these issues that you've discussed. I saw that, you know, you were wearing a kippah on the stage. I know that wasn't always the case. I've also been on my own religious Jewish journey as well. Would love to know a bit more about your own path.
Yeah, sure. So, you know, again, very shameless plug. This is all my book, Israel and Civilization, as well. But I have had a very interesting lifelong journey. I grew up very, very secular. That which not to say that I had no conception of Jewish identity, but my Jewish conception growing up, as with many people who grew up in the United States in Reform Jewish settings, was, you know, you would light the Hanukkah menorah, spin the dreidel. You would go to a Passover Seder, you know, maybe my father would just get a slice of pizza after that, right? I literally don't think that I kid you not, I don't think I knew what Shabbat, the Jewish Sabbath, was until I was in my teenage years. I was really that ignorant of the Jewish religion. Now, frankly, for many people, I think the more natural way to kind of develop a sense of political leanings is you come to your political leanings through your religious worldview. That's certainly the case for a lot of people who grow up in a strong religious setting, whether it's Jewish, Christian, or otherwise, which makes sense. If religion and the God-man relationship is the most important thing in your life, you're going to then arrive at secondary and tertiary conclusions about how the world operates through that overarching prism. But in the book, I explain that I kind of do it in the exact opposite way, actually. I was always on the right. I was always right of center, starting literally in seventh grade after 9/11 happened. I grew up in suburban New York. I saw the smoke from the Twin Towers. You realize that evil exists in the world. When you realize that evil exists, you necessarily know that good exists, because God would never create a world where there's only evil. And once you've snapped out of this utopian kind of John Lennon imagined sort of world and you recognize the moral dichotomy of good and evil, you're already a conservative whether you recognize it. So long story short, you know, the pieces start to come together. And at some point in my early 20s, I start to kind of do a deeper dive into, well, what if I'm a conservative, what does it mean to be a conservative? And I start reading about all these great conservative thinkers, people like Edmund Burke over in Britain, people like Roger Scruton, and on there. And one of the most repeated themes that leaps off the page is this emphasis on this intergenerational transmission of ideals, customs, way of life. Burke refers to this as the bonds between the dead, the living, and the yet unborn, this intergenerational compact. And at some point, the intellectually curious young man must ask himself, okay, if this makes sense to me in the abstract, well, what is my own tradition? Why am I not actually learning this and, you know, doing it? So that actually really was kind of the start. And it didn't happen overnight. And, you know, you take some baby steps along the way, right? But you know, someone said to me, someone recently, he was like, I read your book. Is it true that you essentially came to Orthodox Judaism through Edmund Burke? And I was like, you know what? I never really thought of it that way, but that's kind of basically right, actually. So that's basically it. But, you know, my wife and I now live in Florida. We have a baby, God willing, many more to come. And, you know, my religious journey is far from over. God willing, we'll only grow from here, but it's been a heck of a ride so far.
Wow, wow, wow. Well, that's absolutely amazing and inspiring. And Josh, thank you so much for all you do for standing up for truth, for the Jewish people and for America, and certainly what America, the values America was based on. And I'm actually going to order your book, Israel and Civilization, and I would love to have you on again for a future chat once I've read it so we can talk about it in more detail.
Sounds great. I would love that.
Before we finish, I just want to share with you something really important. We are told that Israel's actions are the cause of the Israeli-Arab conflict, but we've just released a groundbreaking documentary proving that Arab-Islamic Jew hatred far predates Israel's re-establishment. This is a critical fact that everyone needs to learn about. Have a watch of our trailer for our new JTV Plus documentary entitled Arab Antisemitism Before Israel's Re-establishment. Picture yourself. It's 1834 and you're a Jew living in Tzfat, which is a northern city in Israel, then under the Ottoman Empire. Your family is part of this ancient city's spiritual heart for generations. You study Torah, you trade in the market, and live quietly among your Arab neighbors. But one day, a mob storms your street, shouting, "Kill the Jews!" Your home is looted, your synagogue burned, your loved ones beaten. This isn't about Israel. Israel won't exist for 114 years. This isn't about settlements, the IDF, or the 1948 displacements. This is raw, violent hatred aimed at you for being a Jew. And it's not just in Palestine, it's part of a centuries-old story of anti-Semitism woven into Arab and Islamic history, from the dawn of Islam to the streets of Hebron. The claim that this conflict began with Israel's creation, the Nakba, or modern policies, is a farce, a distortion that collapses under history's magnifying glass. Welcome to JTV Plus. I'm Ollie Annesfeld, and today we're uncovering a history too often buried, the relentless anti-Semitism among Arabs in Palestine before 1948, rooted in a broader Arab and Muslim hostility that began with Islam's inception in the 7th century. To watch this JTV Plus documentary and access much more premium content, click on the link in the video description.